Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 2nd of March, these are our main stories. The Greek Prime Minister says the train collision that killed 43 people was unprecedented and caused by human error. Guinea and Ivory Coast send planes to evacuate their citizens from Tunisia after inflammatory remarks by the president against sub-Saharan Africans. And
we are living in fear and constant threat and worry that any moment one of us will be either assassinated or kidnapped at a gunpoint. Life is hell.
A living nightmare for the doctors in Iraq being targeted by militias. Also in this podcast, meet the woman behind the Irish knitwear in a film tipped to win an Oscar.
I've knitted for Christian Bale, Jude Law, Meryl Streep.
And celebrating a lifetime in music for the Canadian singer-songwriter Joni Mitchell. Let's start in Greece, where harrowing images are continuing to emerge of the scene where two trains collided head-on. At least 43 people were killed and dozens were injured in what the country's Prime Minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, has called an unspeakable tragedy. The police have arrested a local station master. The Greek Transport Minister, Kostas Karamanlis, has resigned. Greek newspaper journalist Yannis Papadopoulos has been to the crash scene.
It was a shock, even for us, for journalists who arrived at the site. We saw a train that was derailed. The belongings of the passengers, their seats, were thrown on a field. It was a site of a complete disaster. At least two carriages and the engine of the passenger train were demolished. It was just wreckage. You couldn't recognize that it was a train.
The Prime Minister has also been to the scene of the crash that caused so much carnage and promised to find out what had gone so wrong.
Our thoughts are with the victims' relatives. Our duty is to treat the injured and then to identify the bodies. I can guarantee only one thing. We will find out what caused this tragedy and we'll do whatever we can to avoid anything similar in the future.
The Prime Minister has since spoken on TV to the Greek nation. The British newspaper The Guardian's correspondent in Greece is Helena Smith.
Kyriakos Mitsotakis did give this late-night address after visiting the site of the accident. He said it was clear, very sadly, that what he described as an unprecedented accident in Greece's rail history was down to human error. Human error had contributed greatly to it, but that he vowed to leave no stone unturned in getting to the bottom of all the causes, and that through the creation of a cross-party independent committee of experts that will be set up with immediate effect, the causes would be fully investigated, and that would include long-standing delays, he said, in implementing railway modernization projects. The focus, as the day has progressed, has very much fallen on the sorry state, some would call it the dire state, of the Greek railway network that has remained unmodernized for decades. And when the Greek transport minister tendered his resignation, he described the railway network as not befitting the 21st century. So there is acknowledgement at an official level, the highest level, that the railway network here in Greece is much in need of improvement.
We know there are big queues of people wanting to give blood. Are they still looking for survivors in amongst the wreckage?
They are indeed. Rescuers are saying they've been forced to cut short the search because it's night here. But with the first light of day, they will continue it. They need light, they said, because they need the cranes to work to lift these heavy remnants of the mangled wreckage of the trains. I should imagine at this point they won't be survivors,
but some of the bodies of passengers who were travelling on the train are likely to be found, rescuers believe, beneath this wreckage.
Helena Smith with me from Greece. Israel is embroiled in seemingly unending waves of protests and controversy at the moment. There were more huge demonstrations that led to clashes with riot police on Wednesday over the new government's proposed judicial reforms. And there's been outrage, even condemnation from Washington, after one of the governing coalition's most powerful ministers said the Palestinian village of Hawara should be wiped out. Tim Frank's got an update on both of those stories from our Middle East correspondent Yolan Nell in Jerusalem.
This has been yet another day of protests after a couple of months of sizable protests in Israel. It was billed as a day of disruption, and certainly roads and the rail network all saw disruption. I was at a rally that took place outside of Parliament as well. Many Israelis I spoke to were watching this unfold on their screens at home because it was just so difficult to get into work. Demonstrators in Tel Aviv in particular blocked some streets, including the very busy motorway that comes into Jerusalem. Police there employed stun grenades. They fired water cannon. There were officers on horseback. It was quite an unusual show of force there, and some protesters being dragged away. A number of people were arrested for allegedly rioting. And this all goes back to the government's plans for judicial reform. You have those who oppose these sweeping judicial changes that are being made, saying that they undermine the independence of the courts in Israel. They threaten Israeli democracy. They'll allow things like the government to overturn Supreme Court rulings with a simple majority in Parliament if they all go through. Then you have the Prime Minister, his new hardline government, which includes these members who are nationalist and religious, calling the protesters anarchists. The Prime Minister came out saying that again at the end of the day, saying that these changes are needed to restore balance between the branches of government.
Israeli politics can be very hot-headed and intemperate at the best of times, but I mean, it does seem as if the language is getting ever harsher.
That's right, and there have been these calls from the figurehead president for people in government to come together, for the opposition and the government to hold a sort of national dialogue, try to build some consensus. There have been calls from international allies like the US as well. The US ambassador this week saying to Israelis, slow down a little bit, try to bring people together. But at the moment, there is really no sign that that is happening. I mean, recent polls, interestingly, do indicate the plan is unpopular with most Israelis. They would prefer to have some kind of compromise to be reached. But after Mr. Netanyahu came out with this strong statement, again, criticising the demonstrators, the opposition leader Yair Lapid was quick to respond to that on Israeli TV. He said that he'd made an awful statement and just created a more argumentative situation.
And just very briefly, Bezalel Smotrich, one of the far-right ministers, talk about incendiary rhetoric. He's been doubling down today.
That's right, and there's just been criticism from the State Department, the spokesman Ned Price saying that his comments, where he said that the Palestinian village of Hawara close to Nablus in the occupied West Bank should be wiped out, were irresponsible, repugnant and disgusting. This is something very problematic. You can see that the relationship between the US and the administration here becoming more testy, and especially with Mr. Smotrich, he was supposed to be going to visit the US quite soon, we understand.
Yolan Nell in Jerusalem. Namibia is reeling from the biggest corruption scandal since independence 33 years ago. It's widely known as fish rot. Prominent politicians and businessmen have been charged with racketeering and fraud, which they deny. They're accused of running a corrupt scheme that diverted valuable fishing quotas meant to help ordinary Namibians to a leading Icelandic fishing company and enriching themselves to the tune of almost $20 million. Johannes Dell's been to the country in southwest Africa to find out more about a story that shook the nation.
Rare protests swept through the streets of Windhoek, Namibia's capital, when the fish rot corruption scandal broke back in November 2019. Those protests may have subsided, but the impact of the scandal has not, as sociologist Ellison Chirera found out when he spoke to dozens of fishermen who lost their jobs in the wake of the scandal.
We had stories of people who lost their partners because they couldn't sustain their families anymore. We have had stories of people who had to take their kids out of school and send them to their grandparents because they just couldn't sustain them anymore. I think you can get a sense how this huge corruption scandal touched ordinary lives.
It should have been a very different story.
Now, the coast of Namibia is truly spectacular. In front of me, the cold waters of the South Atlantic are stretching to the horizon. The waves are rolling in. And the water here is really special too, because the Benguela Current makes it one of the richest fishing grounds in the world.
When Namibia gained independence 33 years ago, it set out to reclaim the wealth off its shores, resources that had been plundered by foreign countries for decades. The plan was for fishing to provide jobs, affordable food and revenue for development. But those hopes have been dealt a severe blow. When the fish rod story broke in 2019, it was the result of a rare collaboration of journalists from very different cultures, including Namibia and Iceland. Icelandic broadcaster RUV alleged that Samuri, one of the country's most prominent fishing companies, had paid bribes to gain access to valuable fish stocks in Namibia. The impact surprised even the reporters who'd worked on the story for months. Helgi Seljan is one of them.
Hours after we aired the documentary and released it in English also, two ministers had resigned. And things took off from there, and shortly afterwards, the businessmen had been fired. That was surprising to us.
In Namibia, the headline of the country's leading investigative paper, The Namibian, that day read, "Caught in the net, the fish rod files." The paper's investigative editor is Shinevine Emmanuel.
I didn't expect them to resign. Frankly, I didn't even think they would be touched because they were so powerful. But the wow factor really came when they were arrested.
Two of those arrested were rising stars in Namibia's governing SWAPO party, Fisheries Minister Bernard Esau and Justice Minister Sakir Shangala. The once all-powerful party paid an immediate price at the subsequent elections. Political analyst Roy Tietende.
For the first time since independence, the ruling party lost their two-third majority. The president came from 87% to 56%. So that actually tells you the depth of discontent that prevailed in society because of this fish rod saga.
That saga was based on the fish rod files, a massive collection of over 30,000 documents passed to WikiLeaks by a former director of Samuri in Namibia turned whistleblower. Now, after over 3 years in detention, the suspects are finally heading for trial later this year. It will be the biggest the country has seen, with over 300 witnesses to be called. The Prosecutor General's indictment runs to 144 pages, setting out charges of racketeering, bribery, money laundering and tax evasion against 10 individuals and 18 associated companies. All 10 defendants have protested their innocence. Samuri, meanwhile, has strongly denied paying bribes. But in a statement, it apologized for the manner in which some consultancy payments in Namibia had been managed.
Johannes Dell in Namibia. Doctors in Iraq say they're being deliberately targeted for kidnap and assassination. The latest one to be killed was Dr. Ahmed, a cardiologist who colleagues say saved many lives in Diyala in northeastern Iraq. Thousands of doctors have left the country in recent years. Physicians went on strike in Diyala in fear for their lives. Catherine Birahanga spoke to one doctor in Iraq who knew Dr. Ahmed. He chose to remain anonymous for his own safety.
He was one of best known interventional cardiologists in Iraq and the city. It was a cold-blooded assassination. He was coming home from work in the early hours of the evening. Militia gunmen in a pickup truck approached Dr. Ahmed, who lives in a highly secured area surrounded by police and security forces, and shot him 4 bullets in the head and 1 in the chest. The gunmen ran off after. His killers are well known in the city and to security forces in the city, but there has been no action taken. The militias operate freely in the city, kidnap as well as assassinate professionals and civilians. Other doctors have been threatened recently, including myself and the head of the medical organization, and we are still fearful.
Are you hopeful that you might find out what happened? Will there be an investigation?
Yes, we are protesting for this reason and for protection of other doctors and elites and other professionals, because this crime, not the first crime in the city and Iraq, targeting doctors and other peoples. A month earlier, another doctor who is a senior consultant in obstetric and gynecology was kidnapped for over 10 days and was only released after paying a ransom over $100,000. He was in a pity state from torture A family of 15 were killed in a village in Diyala a week ago, and the attackers again are well known and have links with the militias which control the city.
How do you feel about your safety today?
There is no law or order. The outlaw militias running the show with impunity. We are living in fear and constant threat and worry that any moment one of us will be either assassinated or kidnapped at a gunpoint. Life is hell for us and for our families. The government failed its duty in protecting us and other Iraqis.
How does this affect your ability to treat patients?
I can't focus on my work because I'm worried about my family and my family are worried about me. I think about them all the time. From going to school or shopping, and they think about me when I'm going to work.
An Iraqi doctor with my colleague Catherine Bierahanga. A fishing ban is in place on China's largest river, the Yangtze, and it's led to a resurgence of finless porpoises swimming in the river's waters. Here's our Asia-Pacific editor Celia Hatton.
The Yangtze finless porpoises are known as smiling angels in Chinese because their faces appear to have happy expressions. But things haven't been so happy for the porpoises in the last few decades. The Yangtze River, where they live, has become so polluted and congested that the porpoises' nearest cousins, the Yangtze River dolphins, were declared extinct in 2006. But a recent fishing ban has helped, boosting the animals' food supply. Scientists counted more than 1,200 of the porpoises in 1 month last autumn, a 20% rise from a similar study 5 years ago.
Celia Hatton reporting.
I need to stop this man. I'm still a copper.
Not anymore. And if you refuse to stand down, tactical unit will shoot you dead.
Still to come, from BBC drama to the big screen, Idris Elba talking to us about his new movie, Luther. In Africa, the countries of Ivory Coast and Guinea are dispatching specially chartered aircraft to Tunisia to bring hundreds of their citizens back home after inflammatory comments made last week by the Tunisian president, Kais Saied. Here's Lipika Pelham.
President Saied accused undocumented migrants from sub-Saharan Africa of being behind rising crimes and plotting to change the country's demographic makeup. He ordered security forces to take urgent measures against them, calling them illegal hordes. Human rights groups have criticized President Saied's comments as racist and accused him of sparking violence against migrants. Many of the estimated 21,000 sub-Saharan Africans in Tunisia lost their jobs and housing overnight. Some have reported being physically assaulted. Hundreds of Guineans and Ivorians, evicted by landlords fearing heavy fines for hosting migrants without papers, have since registered with their country's embassies to be repatriated. Many students and workers from sub-Saharan Africa say they're unable to process the paperwork they need because of Tunisia's archaic bureaucracy.
Now it's already showing at select cinemas and comes to Netflix next week. Luther, The Fallen Son, a feature-length canvas on which the main character Idris Elba can develop the character of his dodgy but brilliant detective John Luther, originating on BBC television.
I need to stop this man. I'm still a copper.
Not anymore. And if you refuse to stand down, tactical unit will shoot you dead.
Something's coming.
No spoilers, but the film has a violent edge. It's a thriller. It's edge-of-the-seat stuff. Evan Davis spoke to Idris Elba and the film's director, Jamie Payne, and started by asking Idris Elba why people are so drawn to depictions of psychological and physical torture.
I think that there is the age-old escapism that art is allowing us to have, telling stories. And so we try carefully to be realistic to our world, our Lutherland, as we say, but at the same time, sensitive to what people may find way too much. And it's a hard place to calibrate. But, you know, it is on our minds as producers and directors and storytellers of this IP.
Jamie, in this film, there is a lot of violence. It's fair to say it's equal opportunities violence. It's not all directed against women in particular. But there are a lot of worries about the degree to which violence against women has become a vehicle for entertainment.
I think it's great that there are a lot of very different lenses on stories now, challenging tropes. I think the stories that have gone should exist and be unedited. But I do feel that we have a responsibility in how we balance and tell stories going forward. And I'm glad that we're all having a very, very active conversation. And what you've just mentioned, violence against women is one of them. And there are many others. So I think as humans, we're endlessly fascinated by what the human being is capable of doing at its darkest. There's a dark part of the story towards the end. We took it to a very different part of the world. You know, that allowed us to remind the audience we're in a very much a constructed environment. We never want to be too triggering with the violence in any way. So when we do go into another dark part of the story that violence is a part of, it leans more towards the kind of Grimm's fairy tale with a knight errant in the timelessness of Luther at the centre of it, if that makes sense.
Just moving on to more general matters, Idris, you have said as humans we're obsessed with race and that that can hinder people's aspirations and you don't want to be labelled a black actor. Tell us more about that. Because obviously there are others who think we should really be talking about race. There's a lot of unfinished business there.
It stands for me. I don't speak for anyone else. I speak for Idris. I honestly, really, I'm not here to debate what my opinion is about race. I'm absolutely encouraging of people talking about it because it should be. But to me, my opinion stands. We are obsessed about it. We're always going on about it. And we forget about our similarities because we're so obsessed with what makes us different.
Idris, you did say to a House of Commons committee that you emigrated to the US for those big roles because you thought maybe there was a sort of lack of ambition for black actors here. Firstly, has that changed? But you've come back now, right? You're living in the UK again now.
I live in the UK. I didn't say that I went to America because there was no ambition for black actors. That's not the case. It's just that America had a much larger landscape of work. At the time I moved in the mid-90s, late 90s, there were 200 channels on American soil and there was four in this country. So there was clearly a marketplace ratio that I was leaning into. In the House of Commons, I wanted to really amplify that our TV should look a bit more like the society we come from.
And Idris, are you happy in the UK? There are lots of people who say everything's going wrong in this country at the moment. This is a time to emigrate. Go somewhere, maybe somewhere sunnier or richer or where you can buy tomatoes on supermarket shelves. Are you feeling that at the moment or are you feeling it's all going okay here?
I think there are many more people now feeling displaced than before. And I think we're all feeling a little displaced. You know, the world's in a very jagged, fractured state right now.
Idris Elba and Jamie Payne with Evan Davis talking about Luther out next week on Netflix. Staying at the movies, the Oscars are just days away and with 9 nominations, The Banshees of Inisherin is expected to do well. Set on a remote island off the west coast of Ireland in the 1920s, it tells the story of two friends who fall out after one decides to suddenly end their relationship.
If you don't stop talking to me...
Colin!
And if you don't stop bothering me, I have a set of shears at home. And each time you bother me from this day on, I'll take those shears and I'll take one of my fingers off with them. And I'll give that finger to you until I have no fingers left. Does this make things clearer to you?
Not really, no.
The film is visually stunning, but one thing that really stands out is the knitwear. The knitwear has been in Vogue magazine. The jumpers, worn by actors like Colin Farrell, have been painstakingly recreated from black and white photographs from the time by octogenarian knitter to the stars, Delia Barry, who I've been talking to at her home in County Wicklow.
There were more fishermen, worn by fishermen.
I see.
One of them is a fisherman rib. There is cable in Brendan Gleeson's one, but it's only in the top area.
When did you first get to see the film starring your jumpers?
The week after it first came out.
And did you just go to the cinema with everybody else?
That's it. I went with friends. But at that stage, I didn't know my name was on the credits.
It must have been pretty exciting to see your knitwear on the big screen.
It was. It actually looked good.
Well, everyone said that. I mean, what you should do now is start a business. You'd be knitting knitwear for all of us.
I'm too old. At 83, I'm too old.
Have you done this before? Have you done showbiz knitting before?
Just on and off. I've knitted for Christian Bale, Jude Law.
Yeah.
Meryl Streep.
Do they write to you or send you a message or anything to admire the jumpers?
I've got a message from Brendan Gleeson.
Excellent. Well, I'm pleased about that. And are you going to do more of this now? Because this has brought great attention to your talents.
I'm actually finishing one now for another film, but I can't tell you about it. I'm not allowed to talk about it. I'd have to kill you if I tell you.
Knitter to the stars, Delia Barry, revealing nothing when I spoke to her earlier. Now, there's an age-old saying that opposites attract. It seems in the flamingo world that isn't always true. A study of captive flamingos at a wildlife centre in the English county of Gloucestershire has found out that birds within the group formed cliques of like-minded flamingos. Here's Sally Johnson.
You probably already know that the collective noun for a group of flamingos is, appropriately enough, a flamboyance. But new research has found that within these garish flocks, there are interesting friendship dynamics at play. Flamingos might all look the same, but they are particular about who they spend their time with. Dr. Paul Rose from the University of Exeter is one of the scientists who studied two captive flamboyances in Gloucestershire.
Flamingos have individual and consistent personality types, and these particular personality types influence the friendships they form within the flocks that they live in. This probably gives them advantages when it comes to nesting and breeding and finding a mate and accessing resources.
The researchers also believe that flamingos carve out different roles within their society based on their personalities and offer support to other members of their group, including in flamingo fights and squabbles, to ensure the birds they hang out with remain very much in the pink.
The Canadian singer-songwriter Joni Mitchell will become only the third woman to be awarded the Gershwin Prize, a Lifetime Achievement Award for pop music handed out by the US Library of Congress. She rose to fame in the male-dominated folk music world of the 1960s and 70s. Sarah Montague has been talking to one of her superfans, the British arts journalist Kat Lister, about what makes Joni Mitchell so special.
Rose and flows of angel hair.
The most magical thing about Joni Mitchell is that you can never quite grasp hold of her. She's almost unknowable. And what actually pulls you into her music and her melodies and her lyricism is the fact that you so desperately want to know more about her.
OK, so the albums, the first album you'd reach for is what?
I mean, for me, it's got to be Blue, and I know that sounds very, very obvious. It's number one in my heart for a reason. She's a master of melody, of rhythm, of lyricism. And when that all comes together, it's like this beautiful pearl.
Do you think that she is underrated?
I wouldn't say that she is now. I think things have certainly changed. I'm approaching 40 now. When I was younger, I did lament the fact that she perhaps wasn't celebrated in a similar way. And what I mean by that is she wasn't always very visible to me. That you don't know what you've got till it's gone. So, you know, on the front cover of various music monthlies, you know, you would always see Bob Dylan and Neil Young fairly regularly. It was quite unusual to see her.
You pull out Blue. What else would you flag up that to know Joni Mitchell people should listen to?
As I matured and got a little bit older, I was pulled towards some of her later albums. So Hegira for me in later years has been something that I've really been pulled toward. I looked a coyote right in the face on the road to Belgium near my old hometown. Hegira, loosely translated, is a journey, an exodus. And for me, it's this wide open freeway that really sort of tapped into her yearning for movement. And don't forget that Joni Mitchell had polio as a child. She really struggled with that in her early years.
So she's winning this award tonight and a tribute concert with some serious heavyweights there, among them the likes of Annie Lennox. I think she's only the third woman ever to have been granted this award. So it is a sort of recognition of all that you're talking about.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a long time coming, you know, and perhaps with the health problems that she's been experiencing over the last 5 years or so, we've found this new appreciation for her.
joy and peace. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on.
Cat Lister talking to Sarah Montague about the singer-songwriter Joni Mitchell. And that's all from us for now. There will be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this podcast, drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk or on Twitter. We are at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Danny Cox. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. My name's Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
This week on the podcast, Spark and Fire, writer Susan Orlean.
I had no idea why anyone would steal orchids.
Susan tells the story of writing The Orchid Thief.
A door just opened onto a world that I didn't even know existed. And I thought, I need to know more.
On Spark and Fire, creators share their stories to fuel your creativity. Spark and Fire is a Wait What original in partnership with the BBC. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts.